Hello, I'm Rhea Blakey for Discovery Health. Our program today looks at how physicians can improve their own understanding of risk and communicate more effectively about risk with their patients. We'd like to thank the University of Virginia School of Medicine for accrediting the program. We'd also like to thank Sanofi Aventis for providing the educational grant to make this program possible. Physicians and other healthcare professionals can earn free CME credit by registering online at discoveryhealthcme.com and taking the post-test. All the graphics and references from today's program will also be available online. It's easy to log on, take the post-test, and earn free credit for the program, so do it today. We are fortunate to have a distinguished group of experts in the studio with us today to talk about different ways of understanding risk and about how to help patients make the most informed judgments. Rear Admiral Dr. Sandra L. Queter, Deputy Director, Office of New Drugs, Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Charles H. Hennekins, Sir Richard Dahl Research Professor, Florida Atlantic University. And Dr. Caroline M. Apovian, Associate Professor of Medicine, Boston University School of Medicine. Thank you all for joining us today. During the next hour, we will explain how the FDA uses risk information to evaluate and approve new drugs. We'll describe ways in which patients use risk information to make decisions. We'll explain basic biostatistical concepts, including absolute risk, relative risk, attributable risk, odds ratios, and number needed to treat. We'll offer simplified numeric and non-numeric ways of describing risk, including methods appropriate to patients with low health literacy and low numeracy. And we'll describe methods to verify that patients understand risk information. We're going to spend the next hour talking about risk, and we'll focus on how to communicate with patients about risk. But first, let's take a step back, though, and explain why it's so important for physicians themselves to understand risk.
It's very important for physicians to understand the data first, before they impart anything to the patient. They have to understand the terminology that's being used in the studies, what the study was about, the type of subject that was used in the study, or they won't be able to translate that risk or what that risk means to the patient. Studies have shown that if you use different terminology to explain the same outcomes to physicians, they interpret it differently, so they really need to understand what the different terminology means.
Studies that present risk really usually present it in a mathematical construct, and most of us outside of our jobs don't think in mathematical constructs. And patients, when they're sitting talking to their doctor, aren't thinking about mathematical constructs. So being comfortable enough as a physician to be able to take a risk that's presented numerically and put it in terms that mean something to the individual patient is very, very important.
My observation is that there's a greater awareness on the part of patients than ever before, although that awareness is perhaps out of proportion to the knowledge base, and I think this puts a greater added burden of responsibility on the healthcare providers to understand and communicate risk.
When you look at medical research and drug studies, there's often a lot of information about risk. There's information about the risk of side effects, information about the risk of illness, information about the risk of other problems. Is it enough for the doctors to understand this information, or is it absolutely key for patients to realize what it means as well?
I think it's really important that patients have a general understanding of what to expect, particularly about interventions that affect them. Understanding in an accurate way what the potential benefits are to them and what the potential risks are is really important. No one likes to feel like there was a risk and they didn't know about it. So a, a factual presentation of what may or may not occur, framed in a way that the patient can understand, I think is really important.
I agree completely. My fear is with the bombardment of patients with information from all sources on a daily basis, whether it's print media, video media, the internet, I think there becomes almost a perception on the part of the public, well, if something's not going to get you, something else will, and almost throwing up their hands in despair, when in fact, if we rely on the totality of evidence at any one point in time and put the current findings in that perspective, we show how knowledge is advancing. And I think it's a shared responsibility between the healthcare provider and his or her patient to try to understand and communicate with each other.
Well, what if patients and physicians really just don't have the same understanding of risk? Is there any evidence that this truly affects patient care?
I think it does affect patient care a great deal. So even if a risk is very low, or some would use the term rare, of a particular side effect of a medicine, if the patient who is assuming that risk is really fearful of or dreads that particular side effect, it is going to influence whether or not they take the medicine. An example would be a gentleman with hypertension, and I have a medication that I think would be ideal for this individual. And I counsel him that one of the side effects is possibly impotence. And he nods, and we talk about what the possible, you know, how often that occurs, and he nods, and he leaves the office and never picks up his prescription, because I never asked him, how important is that to you? Mm-hmm. And clearly, by his behavior, it was extremely important. But he's embarrassed to tell me when he comes back that he didn't take the medicine, if he comes back at all. So the conversation about risk is not just about numbers. It's really about what matters to you as a patient.
I think it's a complex issue that includes the communication not only of the risk of the treatment and the potential benefit of the treatment, but what the risk is of the patient who doesn't get the treatment. For example, I've done a lot of work on aspirin and the treatment and prevention of cardiovascular disease. A woman who's had a heart attack has a huge benefit from aspirin. It reduces her risk of a subsequent heart attack, a subsequent stroke, vascular death, are all reduced statistically, significantly, and clinically importantly. And against that backdrop is the risk of about a 60% increase in major bleeding and a 1 to 3 per 10,000 increase risk in hemorrhagic stroke. But the benefits of aspirin in this patient are so large compared to those risks that aspirin should be used very widely in these people. But now, in primary prevention, where aspirin prevents a first heart attack, we don't have enough evidence on stroke and vascular deaths to really understand truly the benefit to risk. I would not want to see a woman of 30 years of age who's unlikely to achieve any benefit from this drug over decades, exposing herself to the hazards over a long period of time. So I think that's an important component of the communication between the healthcare provider and the patient.
Well, doctors, as you've discussed, risk assessment and communication can be extremely important in regards to therapeutic interventions such as medication. But most people are probably aware that the Food and Drug Administration is responsible for verifying that new drugs are safe and effective to use. But we also know there are risks with any drug. We visited the FDA and spoke with some experts, including Dr. Queter, to learn exactly how risk plays into the drug approval process.
On an average year, we approve somewhere between 20 and 25 what we would call really new drugs, meaning drugs that include a active ingredient that have never been approved in the United States before. It's been relatively stable for about the last decade at that level. The statutory standard for the approval of a drug, which we have to base our decisions on, says that the drug has to have been shown to be safe and effective in adequate and well-controlled trials. It's a substantial evidence bar for approval. That bar is the same for all drugs, regardless of the indication. The reality is there is no such thing as a truly safe drug. So in our context, when we decide to approve a drug because we think it's safe, we've made a decision that the risks of the drug don't outweigh the benefits of the drug.
Safe is a relative term. Safe for a product to treat a serious disease like a cancer may be very different than something that is safe to treat headaches. People who have really serious illnesses are willing to accept, understandably, more in the way of risks.
When we say a drug is effective, it means that there have been controlled clinical trials that have shown it has a beneficial effect in the disease that we have approved the drug for.
Interestingly, nothing in FDA regulations says how well something has to work. It just has to work. Does it work in every single person who took the drug? Probably not. Very few drugs do. There are some drugs where only 10% of the people who were treated had a positive effect of the drug. It worked in them. But if there's no other treatment available at all, that could potentially be important.
Our review and approval of an application is very comprehensive. It includes the things that people normally think about, which are how did it work in the clinical trials in patients. We at FDA do not conduct the clinical trials. Those are conducted by the manufacturer of the drug seeking the approval for marketing. We are very involved in overseeing the conduct of those clinical trials. A new drug application includes a vast array of different types of data and results from trials, including clinical trials, studies in animals, laboratory investigations, manufacturing information. It's a very large collection of information that can be hundreds of thousands of pages. When we receive a new drug application, we pull together what we call a multidisciplinary team of reviewers. We have physicians, we have chemists, we have statisticians, we have review by external experts. Well, we call those advisory committees. We can decide that the drug meets all the standards and can be approved. We can also decide that there are deficiencies. And we give the sponsor of the application a comprehensive list of all the deficiencies that we've identified that need to be addressed before we could approve the application.
The difference between the approval process today and 15 or 20 years ago is that science has grown, and the scientific expertise in the disciplines that are looking at the information that companies send to us has grown and become more sophisticated.
FDA has to make decisions on what I refer to as a population basis. We're looking at essentially the average response in determining effectiveness. But the fact that FDA says a drug is safe and effective and has been approved doesn't mean that an individual patient will see benefit and not see risk. It means that the benefits on average to the population studied with that disease appears to outweigh the risk.
One of the things we're doing now is thinking about risk management early in the drug development cycle and not once the drug hits the market or afterward. We're trying to think of these things as early as possible to be as proactive as possible.
Once a drug actually is approved for marketing, it doesn't just go off the radar screen of the FDA. It's ours forever. And we monitor the safety profile of that drug indefinitely. Within the first 3 to 5 years of marketing, we do learn a lot more about its safety profile.
It's very rare, actually, that we learn information about a risk that's so severe that there's a need to take the drug off the market. Historically, only about 2 to 3% of drugs that are approved by FDA are eventually removed from the market for a safety concern.
FDA has taken on much greater emphasis in our role in communicating risk to the public and to healthcare providers. 20 years ago, we were absolutely invisible. We had no voice in communicating information about medicines, which sounds crazy, but it was true.
Our job is to try to communicate what we know about the drug so that the doctor at the bedside can incorporate that into all the complex decisions he or she has to make.
Hello.
There's two main ways we communicate information about the safety of medicines to the public. One is through the product's label. The product's label belongs to the company, but it is reviewed and approved by FDA. And there's labeling both for health professionals, commonly called the package insert, and there's also labeling for patients. The second way is through a variety of different announcements that FDA makes. Once a drug's marketed, we can think of drug safety really as a two-way street. Physicians and others reporting suspected adverse drug reactions to us, we look at the information, we update the label, and send information back out to them. Information for patients isn't a substitute for talking with their physician about the medicine. It's an adjunct to it.
I think it's important for physicians, prescribers, the healthcare community at large to understand they need to carefully assess the information that's provided to them through our approved labeling and other sources in making those individual treatment decisions.
When we make a decision about a medicine, we're balancing a benefit and a risk. Some people say we haven't considered the benefit enough, so we should have approved a medicine that we actually didn't approve. Others would say we haven't considered the risk enough, and we shouldn't have approved a medicine that we actually did approve. And sometimes we get that criticism for the same drug even. I think it's good for us to be transparent about what we're doing and to have a lively dialogue about these decisions, which are very complex.